pace was hot and heavy. It made us want more. We ate for combat the way a teenager longs for a teasing girlfriend. When the bad guys were hiding, we tried to dare them into showing themselves so we could take them out. One of the guys had a bandana, which we took and fashioned into a kind of mummy head. Equipped with goggles and a helmet, it looked almost like a soldier, certainly at a few hundred yards. So we attached it to a pole and held it up over the roof, trying to draw fire one day when the action slowed. It brought a couple of insurgents out and we bagged them. We were just slaughtering them all day. Another day, we were out on an op, and I was up on a roof, watching to see what the locals were up to. As I pulled up my scope, I spotted two guys coming down the street toward me on a moped. The guy on the back had a backpack. As I watched, he dropped the backpack into a pothole. He wasn't dropping the mail, he was setting an IED, an improvised explosive device. "Y'all gotta watch this," I told my spotter, who picked up his binoculars. I let them get to about 150 yards away before I fired my Win Mag. Dauber, watching through the binos, said it was like a scene from Dumb and Dumber. The bullet went through the first guy and into the second. The moped wobbled, then veered into a wall. Two guys with one shot. The taxpayer got good bang for his buck on that one. For the most part, the public is very soft. You all live in a dream world. You have no idea what goes on the other side of the world, the harsh realities that these people are doing to themselves and then to our guys. And there are certain things that need to be done to take care of them all. Edited quote from Chris Kyle's American Sniper and Adam Bernstein's Washington Post article on Chris Kyle's life. Rex! One day, Chris was getting his oil changed at the local auto shop. Some men were in the lobby with him. The guy behind the counter called Chris's name. "Chris Kyle, you're ready." Chris paid his bill and sat back down. One of the guys waiting for his own vehicle looked at him and said, "Hey, are you Chris Kyle, man?" And Chris said, "Yeah, I'm him." "Were you in Fallujah?" "Yeah." "Holy shit, you're the guy who saved our ass." The guy's father was there and he came over to thank Chris and shake his hand. They were all saying, "You were great. You got more kills than anybody. It was awesome." Chris got embarrassed and very humbly said, "Y'all saved my ass too. Thank you for what you did." And that was it. If only we had more men who could keep their mouths shut and work, how much stronger and safer would we all be? Hello and welcome to Battlecast. I'm Dr. Luke Wolf, and today we're picking up just exactly where we left off as we recount the heroic life of Chris Kyle, America's deadliest sniper in our long nation's history. But first, I've got to thank Jim from Redding, California, and Lars from Uppsala, Sweden, for buying us a round. And if you'd like to buy us a round, head over to thebattlecast.com and hit the Make a Donation button. But now let's get back to the greatest sniper in American history, Chris Kyle. All right, so if you remember from last month, it's April 2006, and Chris has just redeployed to Iraq, and he was going straight back into the hornet's nest of combat at a town called Ramadi, a city 30 miles west of Fallujah. For months, Al-Qaeda in Iraq worked like beavers to take over the city of Ramadi, which was the capital of the Anbar province, killing representatives of the American-supported Iraqi government, demolishing buildings, and even paying restitution to local families for property they destroyed. To put it succinctly, Al-Qaeda formed a shadow government operating throughout Anbar province, but especially in Ramadi, the city. American war planners decided to retake the city. In early June 2006, an American airstrike took out the leader of Al-Qaeda in Anbar province. Using a special brigade of troops, which were heavily supported by special forces, American military planners decided to take Ramadi the same way a man eats a steak, one bite at a time. The plan called for American units to move into the city and take and hold small areas one after another. A military historian picks up the story, quote, By the end of June, Lieutenant General Sean Barry McFarland's brigade had established 4 new combat outposts within the city, as well as the heaviest troop density there since the 2003 invasion of the country. The new coalition presence had its intended effects. Within 48 to 72 hours of us setting up a combat outpost, McFarland observed, insurgents would essentially impale themselves on it, and that is why we were able to kill so many. For the SEALs serving under my command, I had one command, kill insurgents, end quote. Chris Kyle had been officially unleashed. Al-Qaeda in Iraq would never be the same. Even today, hundreds of Islamic families mourn the day Kyle was let loose to cut his bloody harvest on the urban streets of Ramadi. It was in this slow-moving, target-rich environment that Chris Kyle began increasing his official kill counts that would later make him the greatest sniper in American history. And it was at Ramadi that Kyle was given the greatest award a warrior can receive, the fear and respect of his enemies. Kyle's biographer explains, quote, Kyle's 5 months in Ramadi were groundbreaking for many reasons. For one, he developed a reputation among the insurgents. The U.S. Marines already referred to him as the legend because of his knack for escaping death. Now, because he was close to setting a record for most sniper kills by a U.S. soldier, the Iraqis started calling him Al-Shaytan Ramadi, the devil of Ramadi. They also put an $80,000 bounty on his head. It made me feel proud, Kyle said when he heard the news. The fact is, I was just one guy, and they had singled me out for causing them a lot of damage. They wanted me gone. I had to feel good about that, end quote. Kyle was on the ground on day one of the attack on Ramadi. He saw the invasion take place from a sniper overwatch position. It's June 17th, 2006, and you're an Iraqi father eating dinner with your family in your two-story rectangular home when all of a sudden 12 giant Americans burst through your front door and scare the crap out of your family. That's how Chris Kyle entered Ramadi. He took position on top of a building and watched the most efficient and best-equipped military in world history begin to capture the city. Quote, with the house and nearby area secured, we called the army in. Hearing the tanks coming in the distance, I scanned even more carefully through the scope. The bad guys could hear it too. They'd be here in any second. The army arrived with what looked like a million tanks. They took over the nearby houses and then began building walls to form a compound around them. No insurgents came. Taking the house, taking the village, it was a non-event. Looking around, I realized the area we had taken was both literally and figuratively on the other side of the tracks from the main city. We had a lot of fighting left to do. End quote. A few nights later, Chris made his first combat patrol into the city itself. To maintain stealth, they went by boat. The enemy was watching the roads and skies. They had few eyes on the water. Kyle's target was in the heart of the city. Chris's unit exited the shallow duck boat and made their way into the heart of enemy territory, traveling by foot. In the moonlight, Chris could actually see the giant cross he had gotten tattooed across his forearm. He wanted everyone who met him to know he was a Christian. He said a silent prayer as his unit pressed forward. There were 24 men in total. Chris was walking point when the laser on his rifle went dark. The battery had run out. Without the laser, he'd be almost shooting blind in the night. The United States owned the night only as long as the batteries held out. Kyle halted the advance. He tells what happened next in his book, American Sniper, quote, what the hell's going on? Asked my lieutenant, coming up quickly. I need to change out my battery real quick, I explained. Without the laser, I'd be aiming blind little better than not aiming at all. No, get us out of here. All right. So I started walking again, taking us up to a nearby intersection. A figure appeared in the darkness ahead, along the edge of a shallow drainage canal. I caught the shadow of his weapon, stared for a moment as I made out the details. AK-47, extra mag taped to the banana clip in the rifle. Mujahideen, the enemy. His back was turned, but he was well-armed and ready for a fight. Without the laser, I would have been shooting blind, so I motioned to my lieutenant. He came up quick, right behind me, and the lieutenant took down the insurgent. He also damn near put a hole in my eardrum, blasting a few inches from my head. There was no time to bitch. I ran forward as the Iraqi fell, unsure whether he was dead or if there were others nearby. The entire platoon followed, spreading out and busting the corners. The guy was dead. I grabbed his AK. We ran up the street to the house we were going to take, passing some smaller houses on the way. Like many Iraqi houses, our target had a wall around it, approximately 6 feet tall. The gate was locked, so I slung my M4 on my shoulder, took out my pistol, and hauled up onto the wall, climbing up with one hand free. When I got to the top, I saw there were people sleeping in the courtyard. I dropped down inside their compound, holding my gun on them, expecting one of my platoon mates to come over after me to open the gate. I waited, and I waited, and I was still waiting. "Come on!" I hissed. "Get over here!" Nothing. "Come on!" Some of the Iraqis started to stir. I eased towards the gate, knowing I was all alone. Here I was, holding a pistol on a dozen insurgents, for all I knew, separated from the rest of my boys by a thick wall and locked gate. I found the gate and managed to jimmy it open. The platoon ran in, surrounding the people who'd been sleeping in the courtyard. There'd been a mix-up outside, and for some reason they hadn't realized I wasn't there anymore. The people sleeping in the courtyard turned out to be just a regular extended family. Some of my guys got them situated without firing any shots, rounding them up and moving them to a safe area. Meanwhile, the rest of us ran to the buildings, clearing each room as quickly as we could. There was a main building and then a smaller cottage nearby. While my boys checked for weapons and bombs, I raced to the rooftop. One of the reasons we'd selected the building was its height. The main structure was 3 stories tall, and so I had a decent view of the surrounding area. Nothing stirred. So far, so good. "Building secure," the communication guy radioed to the army. "Come on in." We had taken our main objective without firing a shot. End quote. The building Chris had just helped take was situated on a key choke point in the city, and the military reinforced it as an outpost, filling the courtyard with vehicles and using sandbags to fortify the perimeter. All the vehicles made the outpost a prime target for the enemy stalking Americans throughout the city. The makeshift fort was a magnet for insurgents. For Chris, it was everything he had ever trained for. Kyle picks up the story, quote, "A couple of insurgents began moving towards the house as the army arrived. The bad guys were armed with AK-47s. Maybe, foolishly, they thought they could scare the armored vehicles off. I waited until they were 200 yards from the tanks before picking them off. They were easy shots, nailed before they could coordinate an organized attack. A few hours passed. I kept finding shots. The insurgents were probing the area, one or two at a time, trying to sneak in behind us. It was never hot and heavy, but there was a steady stream of opportunity. Pop shots, I called them. The army commander estimated we got 24 insurgents in the first 12 hours of the fight. I don't know how accurate that is, but I did take down a few myself that first day, each with one shot. It wasn't particularly great shooting. They were all around 400 yards and less. My WinMag rifle made them flop like white-tailed deer when I shot one," end quote. The next day, Chris and his unit changed positions, moving down the street to a larger building the men called 4 stories because it was, predictably, 4 stories tall. The building had been abandoned, and all Chris and his men had to do was walk in and claim it. Really, you can see the insurgents were often ill-trained or ill-led. Now, I'm not belittling these guys' bravery. I've had veterans tell me to my face that Iraqi insurgents were brave to take on fortified U.S. positions, and I agree with the veterans. But let's face it, it takes guts to face down the United States military with nothing but an AK-47 in your brains. I'm just saying there were tactics the insurgents could have used which they did not. For example, the building Chris Kyle took over as a sort of clubhouse should have been booby-trapped, but it wasn't. Also, the insurgents should have better organized their attacks. Still, they took up the gun and they went to war with the greatest military power in human history, and it takes guts, faith, or stupidity to do that. Maybe they had a little bit of all of them. You got to give him that. Kyle provides his opinion on the Islamic guerrillas he was fighting in his book. Quote, "They targeted the army base, but ineptly. They'd walk, drive, ride mopeds, trying to get close enough to launch an attack. It was obvious what they were doing. You'd see a couple of guys on a moped. The first would have an AK, and the second would have a grenade launcher. I mean, come on. We started getting a lot of shots. 4-story, the building we had turned into our base, was a great sniper hide. It was the tallest building around, and you couldn't get close enough to shoot at it without exposing yourself. It was so easy to pick an attacker off. Dauber says we took 23 guys in the first 24 hours we were there. In the days that followed, we'd get plenty more targets. Of course, after the first shot, it was a fighting position, not a sniper hide. But in a way, I didn't mind being attacked. The insurgents were just making it easier for me to kill them. From then on, the action near 4-story was intense and thick. The nearby army camp was a clear threat to the insurgents, and they wanted it gone. A flood of bad guys came at us. That only made it easier for us to defeat them. Very shortly after Ramadi started, I reached a huge milestone for a sniper. I got my 100th and my 101st confirmed kills for that deployment." End quote. Now, of course, Chris did want to get a high confirmed kill count, and he's honest about that in his book. However, he admits that much about having a high kill count is a product of luck. Snipers have to be in the right place in order to have a high body count. We saw that with the sniper Simo Heriha in our episode we did about him. So if they're guarding the Prime Minister in the middle of the green zone, the safe zone for all the UN employees, they won't have a high body count because they're in a secure area. That's just the way it is. Kyle put it this way, quote, "Honestly, the best snipers don't have much to do with our confirmed kill numbers. They were more a product of how many targets we had to shoot at. It's just the luck of the draw. You want to have the highest numbers, but there's not much you can do about it. I did want to be the top sniper, don't get me wrong. At first, there were three of us who had the most kills, then two of us started pulling away. My competition was in my sister platoon working on the east side of the city. His total shot up at one point, pulling ahead of me. Our big boss man happened to be on our side of the city, and he was keeping track of how the platoons were doing. As part of that, he had the sniper totals. He tweaked me a little as the other sniper pulled out in front. 'He's gonna break your record, Chris,' he'd tease. 'You better get on the gun more, brother.' Well, things evened out real fast, I can tell you. All of a sudden, I seemed to have every stinking bad guy in the city running across my scope. My total shot up, and there was no catching me. It was all the luck of the draw." During the Battle of Ramadi, Chris spent a lot of time simply on overwatch duty, protecting the army infantry tasked with clearing the area around the fortress the military had previously set up in the area. An average day would have Chris on the roof of four-story, watching over the infantry working the streets below him like a mother bird watches her chicks. Whenever a threat came into view, Chris took the threat out. It was in these conditions that Kyle experienced the single bloodiest day of his career. Here's how he remembered it, quote, "I was on overwatch at four-story one morning when some of our guys started doing a patrol nearby. As they moved across the street, I spotted some insurgents coming down J Street, which was one of the main roads in that area. I took down a couple. My guys scattered. Because they didn't know what was going on, someone asked over the radio why the hell I was shooting at them. 'I'm shooting over your head,' I told them. 'Look down the street.' Insurgents started feeding into the area, and a huge firefight erupted. I saw one guy with an RPG. I got him in my crosshairs, squeezed easy on the trigger. He fell. A few minutes later, one of his friends came out to grab the rocket launcher. He fell. This went on for quite a while. Down the block, another insurgent with an AK tried to get a shot on my boys. I took him down. Then took down the guy who came to get his gun, and the next one after him. Target-rich environment? Hell, there were piles of insurgents littering the road. They finally gave up and disappeared. Our guys continued to patrol. Two of the Iraqi coalition forces who were fighting with our guys fell in the combat. It was tough to keep track of how many kills I got that day, but I believe the total was the highest I'd ever had in a single day. It was all the luck of the draw." At the same time, one of the biggest annoyances for the special forces operating in Iraq was the managerial class. The people who do no work whatsoever except micromanage, annoy, bother, and sit on their asses while questioning some of the greatest warriors who ever lived. What is worse is they often claim it's for the good of the people they are harassing. It's a tangible symbol of the American system, and it's all over America. Petty tyrants ruling over police officers, teachers, professors, soldiers, firemen, and private businesses. These are the commissars of America. As one Christian philosopher put it, "These people add nothing whatsoever. They do not plumb, they do not build, they do not protect, they simply measure, complain, and judge without the backing of any supernatural or rational reason for it." At least a real priesthood, as Pascal noted, had the possibility of truly representing divinity. Even the managers admit they represent a system in flux. That's why they talk about the need for change all the time. Hell, they've been running the country since the Civil War. Why do we need to change every few years? The reason is because they don't represent any rational or supernatural doctrine. They represent themselves as a class. This is blatantly apparent in universities, where professors are rewarded for helping the field, making a social science look good, for example. This is a clear and transparent, one might say dangerous, admission that professors' loyalty is to their perception of their own specific field, not to truth, not to reason, not to the people, not to their country, not to anything else. In their own technical documents, when talking with one another, and when there are any gullible journalists around, they often admit much of their work is weak or repetitive. Some even call the work in the field worthless. Remember that the next time a young journalist, making peanuts, tells you studies show something. Studies often don't show shit, except the presuppositions of their authors. Presuppositions affect everything, even what people consider probable or not probable. Anyway, throughout Kyle's book, American Sniper, you can read about how much these commissars annoyed and pestered him, once they even threatened him with jail time. Here's one example, and I could give many from his autobiography, quote, "Every time I killed someone in Ramadi, I had to write a shooter's statement on it. No joke. This was a report separate from after-action reports, which we also had to do, related only to the shots I took and kills I recorded. The information had to be very specific. I had a little notebook with me, and I'd record the day, the time, details about the person, what he was doing, the round I used, how many shots I took, how far away the target was, and who witnessed the shot. All that went into the report along with any other special circumstances. The managers claimed it was to protect me in case there was ever an investigation for an unjustified kill. But what I think I was really doing was covering the asses of people much further up the chain of command. We kept a running tally of how many insurgents we shot, even during the worst firefights. One of our officers was always tasked with getting his own details on the shooting. He, in turn, would relay it back by radio. There were plenty of times when I was still engaging insurgents, still fighting, still saving American lives and giving details to an officer at the same time. It got to be such a pain in the ass that one time when the officer came to ask the details on my shot, I told him it was a kid waving at me. It was just a sick joke I made. It was my way of saying, F off, the red tape of war. We were slaughtering the enemy. In Ramadi, when our kill total became astronomical, the statements became mandatory and elaborate. I'd guess that the commanding officer or someone on his staff saw the numbers and said that the lawyers might question what was going on, so let's protect ourselves. Great way to fight a war. Be prepared to defend yourself from your own people for winning. What a pain in the ass. The way I figure it, if you send us to do a job, get the hell out of the way and let us do it. That's why you have admirals and generals. Let them supervise us, not some fat-ass congressman or lawyer sitting in a leather chair smoking a cigar back in D.C. and thinking about his mistress's breasts. And he's in an air-conditioned office, and he's telling me when and where I can and cannot shoot someone. How the hell would they know? They've never even been in a combat situation. And once you decide to send us, let me do my damn job. War is war. Tell me, do you want us to conquer our enemy, annihilate them, or are we heading over there to serve them tea and cookies? Tell the military the end result you want, and you'll get it, but don't try and tell us how to do it. All these rules about when and under what circumstances an enemy combatant could be killed didn't just make our jobs harder, they put our lives in danger. The policies regarding engaging the enemy got so convoluted and messed up because politicians and lawyers were interfering in the process. The rules are drawn up by lawyers who are trying to protect the admirals and generals from the politicians. They're not written by people who are worried about the guys on the ground. End quote. And neither are the rules governing police officers, teachers, ambulance drivers, first responders, and business owners, not to mention nurses. Everything is made for the pinnacle of the pyramid. There's nothing for you, listener, at the bottom, supporting all the talkers and waste-timers at the top. Meanwhile, the constant combat changed the soldiers. Black humor, darker than anything Monty Python could offer, was always rolling off the tongues of the men in combat. This is a common phenomenon in war. For example, one Rhodesian veteran had special shirts printed for the men in his unit right after the Rhodesian Bush War, which showed a picture of Zimbabwe with the caption, Southern African War Games, Second Place. It's this kind of macabre humor which shows up in many, though admittedly not all, military memoirs. Chris Kyle takes up the story, quote, "The insurgents were using a hospital as a gathering point. As the Marines came into view, a teenager, I guess he was about 15, appeared on the street and squared up with an AK-47 to fire at them. I dropped him. A minute or two later, an Iraqi woman came running up, saw him on the ground and tore off her clothes. She was obviously his mother. I'd see the families of the insurgents display their grief, tear off clothes, even rub the blood on themselves. If you loved them, I thought, you should have kept them away from the war. You should have kept them from joining the insurgency. You let them try and kill us. What did you think was going to happen to them? It's cruel, maybe, but it's hard to sympathize with grief when it's over someone who just tried to kill you. Maybe they'd have felt the same way about us. People back home, people who've never been in war, or at least not that war, sometimes don't seem to understand how the troops in Iraq acted. They're surprised, shocked even, to discover we often joked about death, about things we saw. Maybe it seems cruel, maybe it seems inappropriate, maybe it would be under different circumstances, but in the context of where we were, it made a lot of sense. We saw terrible things and we lived through terrible things. Part of it was letting off pressure or steam, I'm sure of that. It was a way to cope. If you can't make sense of things, you start to look for some other way to deal with them. You laugh because you have some emotion. You have to express yourself somehow." End quote. Kyle was at the prime of his military career, the pinnacle of his life's work. That's when, arguably, the greatest challenge in his career struck. Chris's biographer, explains what happened next. Quote, Kyle's experience in Ramadi was not all ego-boosting and glory-filled. It was there that he endured his first major psychological setback. During a volatile engagement with Iraqi rebels on August 2nd, fellow SEAL Ryan Job was hit in the face with a bullet and permanently blinded. At the time, Kyle and 25-year-old Job were stationed as a two-man sniper team on overwatch duty, Kyle on the rifle and Job as his observer. When the attack occurred, Job was the one who got hit with the bullet, end quote. Now, this is one of the most important events in Kyle's life, so I'm going to let him describe the action at length. Chris would later write in his book American Sniper about it. Quote, one hot, clear summer day, we took a small apartment building with a good view of one of the major east-west roads through the center of Ramadi. It was four stories high, the staircase lined with windows. Ryan Job was my partner at the time. He was joking with me as we went in. He was cracking me up, smiling. I posted him to watch the road. Meanwhile, I watched our guys on the ground. The assault began smoothly, with the soldiers taking first one house and then another. They moved quickly, all of it without a snag. Suddenly, shots flew through our position. I ducked down as a round hit the cement nearby, splattering chips everywhere. This was an everyday occurrence in Ramadi, something that happened not once a day, but several times to us. I waited a second to make sure the insurgents were done firing, then got back up. You guys all right? I yelled, looking down the street towards the soldiers on the ground, making sure they were okay. Yeah, grunted the other sniper. Ryan didn't answer. I glanced back and saw him still down. Hey, get up, Ryan, I told him. They stopped firing. Come on. He didn't move. I went over. What the hell? I yelled at him. Get up! Get up, damn it! Then I saw the blood. I knelt down and looked at him. There was blood all over. The side of his face had been smashed in. He'd taken a bullet. We had pounded into him the fact that you have to always have your weapon up and ready. He'd had it up and scanning when the bullet hit. It apparently hit the rifle first, then ricocheted up into his face. I grabbed the radio. Man down! I yelled. Man down! I dropped back and examined his wounds. I didn't know what to do, where to start. Ryan looked as if he'd been hit so bad that he was going to die. His body shook. I thought it was a death spasm. Two of our platoon guys ran up. They were both trained corpsmen. They slipped between us and started treating him. Mark Lee came up behind them. He took the 60-cal machine gun and began laying down fire in the direction the shots had come from, chasing the insurgents back so we could carry Ryan down the stairs. I picked him up and held him up over my shoulder, then started to run. I reached the stairs and started going down quickly. About halfway, he started groaning loudly. The way I was holding him, the blood had rushed into his throat and head. He was having trouble breathing. I sent him down even more worried, knowing in my heart he was going to die, hoping that somehow, some way, I might do something to keep him going, even though it was hopeless, at least I thought it was. Ryan began spitting blood. He caught his breath. He was breathing. That was a miracle in and of itself. I reached out to grab him and pick him up again. No, he said. No, I'm good, man. I got this. I'm walking. He looked like an extra from Walking Dead, and he stood up and started walking himself down the rest of the way. I couldn't believe it. Meanwhile, the Army rolled a tracked vehicle, a personnel carrier, up to the front door. A member of our team went in with Ryan, and they pulled away. I ran back upstairs, feeling as if I'd been shot, and wishing that it had been me, not him, who was hit. I was sure he was going to die. I was sure I'd just lost a brother, a big, goofy, lovable, great brother. Nothing I had ever experienced in Iraq had ever affected me like this, and my unit returned back to base, end quote. For the next 3 years, Ryan Job would be in and out of hospitals, experiencing numerous surgeries to help restore his vision. Despite these problems, he managed to climb both Mount Hood and Mount Rainier. He also married his girlfriend and had his first child, a girl named Leah. Unfortunately, Job died suddenly on September 24, 2009, during recovery from reconstructive surgery on his eyes. This is the price families pay when their fathers come home broken or in body bags. You men running countries, please don't waste these good men in useless wars. Anyway, as soon as Kyle got back to base, he and his fellow SEALs started planning a revenge operation. Chris takes up the story like this, quote, as soon as we got back to base, I shed my gear and put my back against the wall, then slowly lowered myself to the ground. Tears started flowing from my eyes. I thought Ryan was dead. Actually, he was still alive, even if just barely. The docs worked like hell to save him. Ryan would eventually be medevaced out of Iraq. His wounds were severe. He'd never see again. Not only out of the eye that had been hit, but the other one as well. It was a miracle that he lived, but at that moment at base, I was sure he was dead. I knew it in my stomach, in my heart, in every part of me. I put him in the spot where he got killed. It was my fault he'd been shot. 100 kills, 200 more. What did that mean? My kill count, my little kill count, if my brother was dead. I was in a dark hole, deep down. How long I stayed there, head buried, tears flowing, I don't remember. "Hey," said a voice above me, finally. I looked up. It was Tony, my chief. "You want to go get some payback, Chris?" he asked. "Yeah, I do!" I jumped to my feet. A few guys weren't sure whether we should go or not. We talked about it and planned out the mission. I didn't hardly have time for it, though. I just wanted blood for my guys, not planning. The intel put the bad guys in a house not too far from where Ryan had been hit. A couple of Bradley armored fighting vehicles drove us over to a field near the house. As soon as the ramp dropped on our Bradley, bullets started flying at us. I ran to join the others in my group and found them stacking to go up the stairs to the second floor. Mark Lee was at the lead, above us on the steps. He turned, glancing at a window on the staircase. As he did, he saw something and opened his mouth to shout a warning, but he never got the words out. In that split second, a bullet passed right through his open mouth and flew out the back of his head. He dropped down in a pile on the steps. We'd been set up. There was an insurgent on the roof of the house next door who had shot Mark. That's when our training took over. I scrambled up the steps, stepping over Mark's body. I sent a hail of bullets through the window, flushing the neighboring roof. So did my teammates. One of us got the insurgent. We didn't stop to figure out who it was. We went on up to the roof, looking for more of our ambushers. Another one of our guys, meanwhile, stopped to check Mark. He was hurt, and I mean hurt bad. The tank captain came and got us. They were engaged the whole way, driving in under heavy contact. He brought 2 tanks and 4 Bradleys, and they went Winchester, firing all their ammo. You could hear rounds zinging off the armor. It was shit hot, a fierce hail of lead covering our retreat. On the way back, I looked out the port on the back ramp of my Bradley. All I could see was black smoke and ruined buildings. They'd suckered us, and their entire neighborhood had paid the price. For some reason, most of us thought Mark was going to live. We thought Ryan was going to die. It wasn't until we got back to camp that we heard their fates were reversed. Having lost 2 guys in the space of a few hours, our officers and Tony decided it was time for us to take a break. We went back to Shark Base and stood down. It was August, it was hot, and it was bloody and black. End quote. Mark Lee was the first SEAL casualty since the Iraq War began. And after that, Chris and his fellow SEALs spent a lot of time in their rooms trying to process the dangerous game they were playing. For Kyle, his faith was a comfort to him. Here's how he described the time after losing Mark. Quote, "Some of us were starting to get a little burned out even before our guys got hit. We had been in constant urban combat for weeks. We stayed in our rooms, replacing bodily fluids, keeping to ourselves mostly. I spent a lot of time praying to God. I'm not the kind of person who makes a big show out of religion, I believe, but I don't necessarily get down on my knees or sing real loud in church, but I find some comfort in my faith. I found it in those days after my friends had been shot up. Ever since I had gone through the SEALs program, I carried a Bible with me. I didn't read it all that much, to be honest with you, but it had always been there with me. Now I opened it and read some of the passages. I skipped around, read a bit, skipped around some more. With all hell breaking loose around me, it felt better to know I was part of something bigger." End quote. Chris's wife, Taya, recalls how much Mark Lee's death and Job's wounding affected Kyle like this. Quote, "Chris broke down when he called me with the news. I hadn't heard anything about it until he called. It took me by surprise. I felt grateful that it wasn't him, yet incredibly sad that it was any of them. I tried to be as quiet as possible as he talked. I just wanted to listen. There have been very few times in his life, if ever, that I've seen Chris in that much pain. We sat on the phone for a long time. A few days later, I went to the funeral at the cemetery overlooking San Diego Bay. It was so sad. There were so many young guys, so many young families. It was emotional to be at other SEAL funerals, but this was even more so. You feel so bad, you cannot imagine their pain. You pray for them, and you thank God for your husband being spared. You thank God you're not the one in the front row burying your man." End quote. By this point, Kyle's time in Ramadi was over, but what about the battle itself? How did it turn out? Well, I'll let the official military historians of the Iraq War provide the answer. Quote, "During 1st Armored Division's 7 months in Ramadi, the brigade estimated it had killed 1,500 insurgents and detained another 1,500. McFarland's units had suffered 96 killed in action, while approximately 150 Iraqi soldiers and police had been killed. During those same 7 months, the Iraqi police force in Ramadi had grown to 3,000 strong, occupying stations throughout the city and its tribal belts. Under the force of this new local U.S.-led coalition, insurgent attacks had fallen by 70%. And Ramadi even had managed to hold its first mayoral election since 2004. The burgeoning success demonstrated that American units could exploit local Iraqi motivations, sometimes delivering results that were significant on a regional or even a national scale. For the moment, the 1st Armored Division approach in Ramadi was an anomaly, but before long, it would become the centerpiece of a new strategy that the U.S. President and other senior leaders were desperately seeking, end quote. To put it succinctly, the Battle of Ramadi was a resounding success, and one of the major reasons for its success was Chris Kyle, the man who single-handedly took out scores of insurgents. It wouldn't be the last time Kyle saw combat. He slowly worked back into the routine of providing overwatch for Americans working the streets below him, sort of a deadly guardian angel. But then the call came that took Chris out of Ramadi. A month after Mark and Job had been hit, Chris's wife Taya called him and told him his daughter was very sick. The doctors thought it might be leukemia. Just to let you know, Chris's daughter did not have leukemia, but Chris did not know that at the time, so he dropped everything and came back home, and Kyle was depressed when he did it. He wanted to help his family, but he also felt a deep love and passion to help his other family, the Navy SEALs he worked with and loved. And he was good enough at his job that he really did make a difference on the battlefield. He really could save people's lives and bring home sons safe to their families. Chris later described the conflict between his love of home and his love of his fellow soldiers like this. "It was always a conflict, family and country, family and brothers in arms, that I never really resolved. I still feel like a quitter, a guy who didn't do enough," end quote. Taya, Chris's wife, provides a better description of this time in Chris's life than anything I could ever dream up, so I'm just going to quote her. And as I read this quote, I want you guys in relationships to pay attention because there are some valuable insights into women's needs and actions in these few short lines. Sometimes women hate us and love us at the same time. Be there for her and show her with your actions that you care. I've personally changed thousands of diapers and I do the dishes every night. And I'm not ashamed of that at all, and neither should you be. The women in your life all think they are special and incredibly important. Show them they are just as important to you. Anyway, here's the quote. Quote, "When he got home, it seemed to me Chris was so stressed and numb to just everything. It was hard for him to pinpoint how he felt about anything. He was just wiped out and overwhelmed. I felt sad for everything he'd been through, and I felt terribly torn about needing him. I did need him tremendously, but at the same time, I had to get along without him so much that I developed an attitude that I didn't need him, or at least that I shouldn't need him. I guess it may not make any sense to anyone else, but I felt this strange mixture of feelings all across the spectrum. I was so mad at him for leaving the kids and me on our own. I wanted him home, but I was mad too. I was coming off months of anxiety for his safety and frustration that he chose to keep going back to war. I wanted to count on him, but I couldn't. His team could, and total strangers who happened to be in the military could, but the kids and I certainly could not. It wasn't his fault. He would have been in two places at once if he could have been, but he could not. But when he had to choose, he did not choose us. All the while, I loved him, though, and I tried to support him and show him love in every way possible. I felt 500 emotions all at the same time. I guess I had an undercurrent of anger that whole deployment. We'd have conversations where we talked and he realized there was something wrong. He'd ask what was bothering me and I'd deny it. And then finally he'd press and I would say, I'm mad at you for going back, but I don't want to hate you and I don't want to be mad. I know you could be killed tomorrow. I don't want you to be distracted by this. I don't want to have this conversation. Now finally he was back and all of my emotions just exploded inside of me, happiness and anger all mixed together. Little by little, I realized I wasn't the most important thing in his life. The words were there, but he didn't really mean it. In a way, the SEALs were his family. I remember talking to a girlfriend who'd been through an awful lot. I just unloaded on her. And she said to me, well, this is what you have to do. You have to lay it all on the line. You have to tell him that you love him and you want him to stay, but if he wants to go, he's free to do so. I took her advice. It was hard, a very hard conversation I had with Chris, but I knew several things in my heart. First, I knew I loved Chris, and second, and this was very important to me, I knew he was a good dad. I'd seen him with our son and with our daughter. He had a strong sense of discipline and respect, and at the same time, he had so much fun with the kids that by the time they were done playing, they all ached from laughing. Those two things really convinced me that I had to try to keep our marriage together. From my side, I hadn't been the perfect wife either. Yes, I loved him truly, but I'd been a real bitch at times. I'd pushed him away. So both of us had to want the marriage, and we both had to come together to make it work. End quote. It took a lot of time, and it wasn't perfect, but eventually Chris and Taya saved their marriage. One of the biggest problems was Chris's enlistment in the military. He had 2 years left to go, and he wanted to re-enlist, but Taya explained to him that she and their children needed him home, so Chris did not re-enlist. He chose his family, and he made the right choice. How many of you can say the same thing? Chris may not have re-enlisted, but he still had time to serve. And before his time was up, he had one last combat deployment to the town of Seder City in the spring of 2008. Here's how Chris describes the city, quote, "Located on the outskirts of Baghdad, Seder City had become even more of a snake pit since the last time I'd been there. 2 million Shiites lived there. The rabidly anti-American cleric Al-Sadir had been steadily building his militia, the Mahdi Army. There were other insurgents operating in the area, but the Mahdi army was by far the biggest and the most powerful. With covert help from Iran, the insurgents had gathered arms and started launching mortars and rockets into Baghdad's safe green zone, which wasn't so safe anymore. The entire place was a viper's nest. It was a hellhole. I scanned the darkness through my night vision while looking out at one of the nastiest streets in Seder City. The buildings were all drab brown, and the streets looked depressing and sad. There were rows of what might have been condos in a normal city. Here, they were little better than rat-infested slums." End quote. In other words, Seder City was mired in poverty and steeped in conflict. Kyle was right in the middle of it all. It was in Seder City that Chris was almost blown apart. He was clearing a building when he heard a small thump behind him, as if a child was absent-mindedly throwing a toy on a wooden floor. Then the whole room simply exploded. It was a miracle Chris wasn't hit when the grenade went off. Chris and his comrades started taking gunfire. They realized most of the insurgents had fled the building they were clearing. Someone screamed, "Out of the house now!" Chris picks up the story. "The last of my guys had just cleared out of the building when the street shook with a huge force. The insurgents had set off an IED down the street. The blast was so powerful it knocked a few of us off our feet. Ears ringing, we ran to another building nearby. But as we were about to enter it, all hell broke loose. We got gunfire from every direction, including above us. A shot flew into my helmet. The night went black. I was blind. It was my first night in Seder City, and it looked like I was going to be blind for the rest of my life. There I was, shot in my head and blind. Blood streamed down my face. I reached up to my scalp. My head was still there, but I knew I'd been shot. Somehow I realized that my helmet, which hadn't been strapped, had been pushed back. I pulled it forward. Suddenly I could see again. A bullet had struck the helmet, but with incredible luck had ricocheted off my night vision, slamming the helmet backward, but otherwise not harming me. When I pulled it forward, I brought the scope back down in front of my eyes, and I could see again. I hadn't been rendered blind at all, but in the confusion, I couldn't tell what was going on. A few seconds later, I got hit in the back with a heavy round. The bullet pushed me straight to the ground like I was getting body slammed. Fortunately, the round hit one of the plates in my body armor. Still, it left me dazed. It would have you, too. Meanwhile, we were surrounded. We called out to each other and organized a retreat. We started laying down fire and moving together. By this time, the blocks around us looked like the worst scenes in Black Hawk Down. It seemed like every insurgent wanted a piece of the idiot Americans who foolishly blundered into Seder City. We couldn't get into the building we retreated to. By now, we'd called for a quick response force, a fancy name for the cavalry. We needed backup and extraction, and we needed it quick. A group of army strikers came in. Strikers are heavily armored personnel carriers, and they were firing everything they had. There were plenty of targets. Upward of 100 insurgents lined the roofs on the surrounding streets, and they were all trying to kill us. When they saw the strikers, they changed their aim, trying to take out the army's big personnel carriers. It was no contest. Their small arms fire couldn't penetrate the strikers' armor. It started looking like a video game. Guys were falling off the rooftops. "Thank you," I said aloud when the vehicles reached our building. "Thank you so much." They dropped their ramps and we ran inside. "Did you see how many were up there?" said one of the crewmen as the vehicle sped back to the base. "No," I answered. "I was too busy shooting." They were all over the place. The kid was stoked. We were dropping them, and that was even half of them. We were just laying it down. We thought y'all were done for. That made two of us. That night scared the shit out of me. That's when I came to the realization that I'm not Superman. I can die. End quote. Seder City turned out to be what Chris called a target-rich environment. On one day, he killed 7 insurgents. The next day, he shot 8. He was constantly engaging the enemy. And he provides the details in his autobiography. Quote, Seder City was the worst. The overwatches would last 2 or 3 days without rest. We'd leave for a day recharge, then go back out. It was balls-to-the-wall firefights all the time. The insurgents brought more than just their AKs to a fight. We were getting rocketed every fight. We responded by calling in air cover. One day, we took over this house, and after letting my guys choose their places, there were no more windows to fire from, so I took a sledgehammer and broke a hole in the wall. It took me quite a while to get it right. When I finally set up my place, I had about a 300-yard view. Just as I got on my gun, 3 insurgents came out right across the street 15 yards away. I killed all of them. Gradually, the bad guys gave up and faded into the slums around us. Al Sadir, the local warlord, meanwhile, decided it was time for him to try and negotiate a peace with the Iraqi government. He declared a ceasefire and started talking to the government. End quote. After the combat in Seder City died down, Chris was redeployed to small villages in the area. It was during this time that Kyle achieved his longest confirmed kill. It happened like this. Chris was set up in a room on the second story of a building when he saw someone on a roof a long way away. I mean a long way, 2,100 yards away. That's 21 football fields. Chris was using his .338 Lapua rifle. He saw the guy moving, but even with his professional $1,000 scope, he couldn't make out more than the outline of the guy from so far away. I'll let Chris tell you what happened next. Quote, a little while later, an army convoy came down the road beyond the other village. As it got closer, the man on the roof raised a weapon to his shoulder. Now the outline was clear. He had a rocket launcher, and he was aiming it at Americans, an RPG. We had no way of calling the convoy directly, but I put my scope on him and fired, hoping to at least scare him off with the shot, or maybe warn the convoy. At 2,100 yards plus a little change, it would take a lot of luck to hit him. I mean a lot of luck. Maybe the way I jerked the trigger to the right adjusted for the wind. Maybe gravity shifted and put that bullet right where it had to be. Maybe I was just the luckiest son of a bitch in Iraq. Whatever. I watched through my scope as the shot hit the Iraqi, who tumbled over the wall to the ground. Whoa, I muttered. You dumb, lucky bastard, said the man next to me. 2,100 yards. The shot amazes me even now. It was a straight-up luck shot. No way one shot could have gotten him, but it did. It was my longest confirmed kill in my career. End quote. A few days later, Kyle was transferred away from the front line to rear duty near the Syrian border. Nothing much happened during this time. Chris was promoted to chief petty officer and was tasked with administrative duties. In other words, his frontline days were over. He put in his time, and a few months later, war and combat were over for Chris Kyle. He would not be reenlisting. The greatest sniper in America had figuratively hung up his rifle. And who says Allah doesn't answer prayers? In his excellent book on the Vietnam War entitled Dispatches, Michael Hare describes the effect combat and too much knowledge has on both soldiers and extremely serious intellectuals. It makes their minds unable to stop working. Gordon Wood described the same problem in an interview he gave to Book TV. I've had and still have the same issue, though, of course, I believe combat soldiers experience much worse symptoms of this than hardcore intellectuals. This same problem happened to Chris Kyle. He couldn't relax. He couldn't slow down. His mind was going 1,000,000 miles an hour. Here's how he remembers the last months of his final deployment. Quote, back at base, things were incredibly slow. Nothing was going on. It started to get to me. As long as I had been in action, the idea of my being vulnerable, being mortal, had been something I could just push away. There was too much going on to even worry about it. Or rather, I had so much else to do, I couldn't really focus on it, but now it was practically all I could think about. I had time to relax, but I couldn't relax. Instead, I'd lie on my bed thinking about everything I'd been through, getting shot especially. I relived the gunshot every time I lay down to rest. My heart thumped hard in my chest, probably a lot harder than it had that night in Seder City. Things seemed to go downhill in the few days after we had first gotten back from our border patrol. I couldn't sleep. I felt very jumpy, extremely jumpy, and my blood pressure shot up again, even higher than before. I felt like I was going to explode. Physically, I was beat up. 4 long combat deployments had taken their toll on my body. My knees felt better, but my back hurt, my ankle hurt, my Hearing was screwed up. My ears rang. My neck had been injured. My ribs cracked. My fingers and knuckles had been broken. I had floaters and decreased vision in my right eye. There were dozens of deep bruises and an assortment of aches and pains. I was a doctor's perfect dream. But the thing that really bothered me was my blood pressure. I sweated buckets and my hands would even shake. My face, pretty white to begin with, became deathly pale. The more I tried to relax, the worse things got. It was as if my body had started to vibrate, and thinking about it only made it buzz more. I was coming apart, and soon I would be going home, end quote. In August 2009, Kyle left Iraq and never returned again. His time as a soldier was over. Now he had to learn to be a father and a husband. As you can probably imagine, it wasn't easy. Crisp was 35 and unemployed. What would he put on his job application? Bronco buster and professional killer? Granted, in many parts of the country, being a Navy SEAL wouldn't hurt a job applicant, but still, Chris wasn't sure where to start. Plus, he was relearning how to be a husband and father again. It took a lot of work, but Chris was able to save his marriage, and that was something. Then Chris met a successful investment professional named J. Kyle Bass, who was looking for a bodyguard. Alexis Burling details what happened next. Quote, before long, Bass and Chris were drawing up the paperwork for Chris's new business. It would be called Kraft International, with training sites in Arizona and Texas. Kraft International's logo would be a skull representing Chris's life and military service. During Thanksgiving and Christmas, Chris and his family relocated back to the Dallas, Texas area so he could run operations from Kraft International's corporate offices in Dallas. Kyle's new job was rewarding. He also volunteered his time and resources to help wounded veterans. But he still spent most of his off time drinking and carousing in bars. One night, he had too much to drink and drove off the road, crashing his truck to pieces. He nearly died. The thought of leaving his kids without a father scared him. It was time for Kyle to stop feeling miserable and to get his life back on track. The accident woke me up. I'm sorry to say that I needed something like that to get my head back straight, he said. I finally realized everything I have and everything I could lose. And I also finally understood not just where my responsibilities were, but how I had to meet those responsibilities, end quote. As with everything else in Kyle's life, he was all in on changing for the better. He invested all of his focus and energy on improving. He went to church more often. He started eating healthier food. He drank less alcohol and made more of an effort to exercise and get a good night's sleep. At his wife's suggestion, they went back to marriage counseling and planned more romantic evenings together. And he started spending more time with his kids. In February 2013, at the time of his death, Kyle was more settled than he had ever been since leaving the SEALs in 2009. He loved being a faithful husband and devoted father to his children. He was doing what he could to help wounded veterans heal, and he felt more at peace about not being in active combat. Then everything changed. He had survived literally hundreds, perhaps thousands, of insurgents actively trying to kill him. He never could have imagined his death would come at home by the hands of a fellow American and a veteran, the two kinds of people he tried most to help. And what about you, listener? I know you. You see all the sniveling and stupefying advertisements and idiotic television shows on streaming services. Everyone's smiling and breaking every moral that has ever existed in human history. Your debt piles up. You lose the people around you. Still the advertisements smile at you. Still the bosses on top of the pyramid want you to buy their Chinese trinkets. It might have been good enough when you were a teenager, but now you're growing up. And now you see you sold your family, your communities, and your birthright for a bowl of soup. And so, like Chris, I would say to you, beware, for you never know when pain and problems are coming. Sometimes they come where you least expect it. And so death came for Chris Kyle. It's coming for you too, listener. It may be 3 years or 30 years away, but it's coming. When you die, do you want those you care about to say, well, he was really good at watching Netflix and drinking wine, because there is another way. I've pointed it out to you for 75 episodes now. But now let me tell you how death came for Chris Kyle. On February 2nd, 2013, Kyle met up with a veteran. He was trying to help transition back into civilian life. The man's name was Eddie Ray Ruth. The two planned to go out to Rough Creek Lodge to spend some time on a shooting range. Apparently, Eddie simply shot Kyle and another man who was working with them at point-blank range and then stole Kyle's expensive truck. Alexis Burling provides the best summation of Eddie's motives, so I'll just quote her. Quote, barely 1 hour after Ruth murdered Kyle in cold blood, he appeared at the door of his sister's house with a set of new keys in his hands. He announced he was the proud owner of a brand new vehicle. I sold my soul for a truck. We went up to the gun range and I killed them, Ruth said. Chris and his friend, I killed them. I murdered them. When his sister Laura looked out and saw the fancy black truck in her driveway, she knew her long troubled brother was telling the truth. She begged him to turn himself in. Ruth gave Laura a hug, told her he loved her, and left. She immediately called the police and explained what had happened. Later that evening, the cops caught up with Ruth at his parents' house in Lancaster, Texas, where he was living at the time. They questioned him for approximately 15 minutes, but Ruth left the house before they could find out anything substantial. The police raced after him. When they finally caught up to him near Dallas, Ruth confessed everything. He hadn't even driven the truck he killed two men to steal for one full day. Meanwhile, on February 11th, 9 days after Chris's murder, a public memorial service was held for Kyle. Close to 7,000 mourners filled AT&T Stadium in Dallas to pay their respects. Kyle's American flag-draped coffin sat at the 50-yard line. The next morning, 200 motorcycles, police cars, and military vehicles escorted Kyle's body on its 200-mile journey from his home to the Texas State Cemetery in Austin, the capital of Texas. Flags were draped across bridges, and thousands of people lined the roads and highways to watch as a white hearse carried Kyle's coffin to his grave. End quote. There's not much more a nation could do to honor a fallen son, and Texas did right by Chris after his death. On February 24th, 2015, Eddie Ray Ruth was sentenced to life in prison. He took away a son and a daughter's father and a wife's husband and a nation's hero for a few hours in a stolen car. Eddie Ray Ruth killed two men for a shiny new truck he wouldn't even be able to use for, at best, more than a few days before he was caught and the truck was taken away. And our leaders say people are basically good. Ask Chris Kyle if people are basically good. His grave tells you the answer. Now, I have to tell you, a controversy does exist over Kyle's war record, but so far as I can tell, no one has seriously questioned Kyle's 160 kill count, and according to Adam Bernstein, the military refuses to confirm the number of kills of any sniper, so the official truth is impossible to prove one way or another. Regardless of the official number, the next closest American sniper was Adalbert F. Waldron III, who was credited with 109 kills in Vietnam. For me, there is practically no doubt that Chris Kyle beat Waldron's record, and thus he is the greatest sniper in American history. But Kyle wouldn't care about that one way or the other. He said he didn't care about the number of kills he racked up in his book. Thomas Gibbons Neff provides the best summary of Kyle's war record when he wrote the following in the Washington Post, so I'll quote him, quote, "What isn't in doubt, however, is Kyle's performance on the battlefield. His record now notes that besides his one silver star, he earned 4 bronze stars with V for Valor, Distinguishing Devices instead of 5, and a Navy Achievement Medal with a V during his time fighting in Iraq," end quote. Now, one thing Kyle did do was make some controversial and even exaggerated statements. If you want, you can read a great summary of them in Thomas Gibbons Neff's Washington Post article, but I'm not going to go through them all here. They're easy enough to find in the citations I've included on the website. Bragging or not, exaggerated or not, Chris Kyle was one of America's and the world's greatest warriors. This show isn't about a mistake he made running his mouth on late night television or in an interview with a fawning journalist. It's about the career and exploits of a man who saved many American lives and took many lives as well. It's the story of Chris Kyle, sniper, father, American. Before I go, I should tell you that Chris Kyle was hated by many people across the world, but don't take my word for it. Here's how one journalist described the campaign of contempt unleashed on Kyle's legacy, quote, "There was a broad campaign of derision aimed at Kyle's memory following the release of American Sniper, a Guardian editorial in a story that collected 153,000 Facebook likes, called him a hate-filled killer. Journalist Rania Kalik described him as an American psycho, bound by hatred, bigotry, and enthusiasm for killing Iraqi savages. Filmmaker and liberal activist Michael Moore called snipers cowards," end quote. All I can say, if anyone thinks Chris Kyle is a coward, they can go take the Navy SEALs training course, get blown up by grenades, have their legs smashed, fight without respite for days and weeks straight, and clear buildings room to room in the heart of some of Islam's most fanatical cities, and then you can tell me Chris Kyle was a coward. Chris Kyle was many things, but he was not a coward. I know that this episode likely offended many people, and I want everyone listening to know I want to live in peace with the people who disagree with me. I really do. I mean that sincerely. I want to mind my own business, and I want to let you mind yours. I might ask you, though, if we're all just matter in motion, we're just evolved slime, why do you get mad with Chris Kyle's words and actions? After all, one ape just did something to some other ape. So what? According to your worldview, it shouldn't matter. Now, I don't think that personally, but you might try reflecting on your own values. I believe and publicly affirm that murder is now and forever always wrong. But I have a firm foundation for that belief. You do not. And so maybe there is something more to humanity than just materialism or idiotic pragmatism that's been leading us down the path of anger, the path of dissolution, and the path of rot. Your anger at Chris certainly points to something more, something higher, something vertical. Anyway, that's another one in the books for me. Before I posted this show, I sent it to a good friend of mine named Mark in Birmingham, and I told him this was the perfect podcast episode. He wrote me back and told me it was not the perfect podcast because it hadn't said anything at all about mama or trains or trucks or prison or getting drunk. Well, I went and said a few more lines to this episode, and after I said them, I realized that this was the perfect podcast episode. And the rest of the show goes like this here. Well, I was drunk the day my mom got out of prison, and I went to pick her up in the rain. But before I could get to the station in my pickup truck, she got run over by a damned old train. And once again, I'm Dr. Luke Wolf, and I'll hang around as long as you will let me. And as always, I want to thank everyone who bought us around and everyone who writes in telling me how much they love the show. But until next time, I'm Dr. Luke Wolf, and I'm wishing you good times in good weather with good people. Bye. Rick, this bud's for you, brother.